There is some uncertainty creeping into the weather forecast. The heat is sticking around, and it's going to stick around, but rain is seeping into the outlook models. The first hint of it came overnight, and that sent corn futures moderately lower. Prices are still lower, but corn is trading mid-range as traders wait just one more hour for the next run of the models.
Live from the land of the blazing sun via Farm Journal broadcast, this is AgriTalk. This morning we'll chat with Eric Mittenthal, Vice President of Sustainability for the North American Meat Institute and President of the National Hot Dog and Sausage Council. Then it's on to Ed Elfman from the American Bankers Association. And right after the news, Annalisa Laca from Farm Journal's Milk. I'm handsome newsman Davis Michelson. Now, here's your host, Chip Lorre.
All right, Davis, thank you so much. Yes.
You know, Chip, you hear all kinds of things about fashion models, about hand models, about makeup models. But you really don't hear much about weather models. You know, and I think they're the most useful models of all, aren't they?
I think so. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Not to say anything about any of the other models.
Uh-huh.
You know, I don't want to diminish the importance that they play.
Sure.
Okay. But uh-huh. I probably pay more attention to the weather models than any of the other ones.
Yeah. Well, yeah. the weather models, they're hotter, if you ask me. It seems like it these days anyway.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And there is some rain that is starting to work into some of the weather models. It's like I said, it started last night. We're going to get a noon Eastern time update on the runs. And when we do, it will what the next run of the models shows us is going to be reflected in the afternoon corn trade. I mean, there's just no doubt about it. If those rains stick in there, we're going to go back down to the lows probably that we saw in Dease corn in the overnight session, down just under 350. If the weather models take the rain out again, then we'll probably be making a run right back up to the highs that we saw yesterday. So,
okay,
it's that type of market and that time of year, dude. No doubt about it. All right. Hey, before we get to Annalisa, let's go ahead and get to the news. What do you got?
Well, hey, let's hit some highlights from USDA's crop progress and condition update. That's for the week ending July 5. Corn is 10% silking, 71% good to excellent. Soybeans, 31% blooming, 2% setting pods, 71% good to excellent. Spring wheat is 63% headed, 70% good to excellent. Cotton is 47% squaring, 13% setting balls, 43% good to excellent. And winter wheat is 56% harvested and 51% good to excellent. Now, these corn and soybean ratings, each at 71%. If I'm remembering right, that's like 15, pushing 20% better than year ago, right? 20 points better than year ago at this time?
It may be. You know what? I did not look at that. To be honest with you, Davis, but you know, everything's pushing along at pretty typical rate. I'm a little surprised that we didn't see more of a dip in the corn rated good to excellent, soybeans rated good to excellent. I just kind of anticipated that some of the stress that I saw over the 4th of July weekend would be reflected. Yeah. And it's not really there.
Yeah. There's some pineapple fields out there. I tell you what, maybe we'll see it in next week's update. We'll keep an eye on that. Well, Chip, Atlanta Fed Bank Chief Raphael Bostic told the Financial Times that he is concerned by data pertaining to business openings and the recent spike in coronavirus infections within his district and in the western United States. Economic activity appears to be leveling off as the reopening sputters. Bostic said the Atlanta Fed was, quote, trying to figure out this leveling off is something that is more a sustained pattern or just a pause. He said his biggest concern in this whole period is to what extent are business losses permanent or are job losses permanent? Nabostic's comments echo those of Fed Chairman Jerome Powell, who has also repeatedly expressed concern over permanent business closures and the related job losses, Chip.
Yeah, it is hard for some of these businesses to find the financial means to open the doors again. And if they're not opening the doors, they're obviously not giving people their jobs back. And there's going to be some permanent losses out of this. It's going to take a while to get all the way back.
Well, Chip, U.S. Trade Rep Bob Lighthizer and Chinese Vice Premier Liu He are planning a visit via telephone in mid-August to assess the implementation of the Phase 1 trade deal. As of May, China's purchases of all covered products under Phase 1 were $26.9 billion. That's only around 45% of their year-to-date targets, according to Chad Bowen, a senior fellow and trade expert at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Got some catch-up to play there, Chip.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll continue to dig into this story this week because it is a story that is obviously gaining in importance. And we talked with U.S. Trade Rep Bob Lighthizer last week, and he did mention, or maybe it was 2 weeks ago, and he did mention that he was going to be having that conversation with his counterpart in China in mid-August.
Well, Chip, this is interesting. The short video platform TikTok, which is owned by Chinese tech firm ByteDance, says it will pull out of Hong Kong within a week. This as Beijing imposed a national security law for Hong Kong that includes empowering police to order internet companies to remove content deemed threatening to national security. Yeah. Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said he is considering banning Chinese-based social media platforms like TikTok in the U.S. amid concerns the data could be accessed by Beijing. And one more thing real quick here. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is looking out to the end of this month when he believes a final coronavirus aid package will be issued. Chip.
All right. Thank you very much, Davis. Let's bring in Annalisa Laca, editor, Farm Journal's Milk. How you doing, Annalisa?
I'm doing great. How are you, Chip?
Good, good, good. Another thing that's doing great are dairy exports, right?
Oh, man. We just got our May numbers from the U.S. Dairy Export Council, and dairy exports in May, despite the coronavirus, hit a two-year high in terms of total volume. And we also saw record sales in non-fat dry milk and skim milk powder, which is impressive considering, you know, what was going on in the world during that time.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, did the disruption in our processing here in the U.S., did that add to the exports, do you think?
You know, I'm not sure. I think, you know, when we look at the products that did really well in May, it was, like I mentioned, non-fat dry milk, skim milk powder. We did see strong shipments of cheese, which is where we saw most of those production hiccups happen in you know, domestically. But we also are shipping a lot of lactose and a lot of whey.
Yeah.
And, you know, when we think about where most of that whey is going, most of it's going to China. As they look to rebuild their hog herd following, you know, what they've had to deal with ASF.
Right, right, absolutely. You know, another thing that should be helping us out on our exports going forward is we've implemented USMCA. We've got the Mexican president at the White House tomorrow. That Mexican market is so important, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It's our number one export market in the United States. We send a lot of cheese to Mexico. And so we are really looking forward to having, you know, a strengthened and renewed relationship there, not losing anything that we had before in the original NAFTA. So I think, you know, dairy farmers are bullish on USMCA implementation. I think if you look at the markets yesterday, dairy markets indicate that the industry as a whole is excited about USMCA.
Yeah, absolutely. No doubt about that. All right, Annalisa, thank you so much. We'll talk to you again next week. All right, Annalisa Laca, editor, Farm Journal's Milk. When we get back, we're going to have a conversation with Eric Mittenthal, president of the National Hot Dog.
Your next piece of equipment is on MachineryPete.com. Search equipment from dealerships across the country to find what you're looking for. Only on MachineryPete.com.
You think Greasehog has a spokes dog? And if so, do you think it's a Greasehog dog?
Yes, I do.
It occurs to me.
I do. The Twitter game is strong out there today.
It's happening.
Thanks, Charlotte. It's happening. Yes, thank you, Sam. Appreciate that. Lizzie at Oto Creek Cattle, Chad. Yep. The Twitter game is strong, no doubt about it. All right, let's get this conversation going with Eric Mittenthal. He is Eric is the president of the National Hot Dog and Sausage Council, which I knew this was going to be a mistake with Davis.
My goodness.
Sausages. The council is a project of the North American Meat Institute, where Eric is vice president of sustainability. Eric, welcome to AgriTalk. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's National Hot Dog Month, so always every day is happy for me.
No doubt, no doubt. Kicks off with the big 4th of July weekend, the hot dog eating contest. This is the spotlight is on your product.
Yeah, well, you know, Americans love hot dogs, so the spotlight's always on hot dogs to an extent, but this month in particular is our prime time, and we celebrate hot dogs throughout the month and really have a lot of fun with it.
Excellent, excellent. So tell us about the North American Meat Institute and who it represents.
Sure. Our members at the Meat Institute are meat packers and processors. We produce 95% of the red meat in the U.S. and 70% of the turkey. And it's everyone from your very largest Tyson, Smithfield, JBS Cargill to Uncle Charlie's Sausage Company. And the National Hot Dog and Sausage Council is a project that's funded by hot dog and sausage manufacturers within our membership. And we aim to be kind of the checkoff for hot dogs to an extent to make sure we're leading the promotion of them.
Right, right. You know, when you're representing a membership like that, Eric, obviously there's going to be some conflict between the big four and some of the smaller processors out there. But boy, there is a push in the industry. I don't care if we're talking about pork, beef, poultry. It seems like the producers want more of those smaller processors out there. Are you seeing that as a trend?
Yeah, we're certainly hearing that coming out of the pandemic, especially some of the supply chain issues that we've seen. But I think there's room for all sizes. We certainly need large companies. We need smaller companies and everybody in between. And so, our members are doing everything they can to keep the supply chain moving and produce the meat and poultry products that Americans love.
Boy, and keeping that supply chain moving this year has been an extraordinary challenge, no doubt about that. Eric, what is the mission of the North American Meat Institute?
Well, we've been very focused on highlighting the sustainability of our industry in the last year in particular. That's been my role, is taking on a major trust in animal protein initiative that really aims to address issues that consumers have on animal proteins and make sure that we as an industry are improving as best we can, but then also telling our story as best we can. So that's been a huge focus of ours and is going to continue to be in the foreseeable future.
Excellent. Excellent. Okay, let's get back, celebrate some hot dogs here. We need to talk about a couple of the challenges that the industry is facing too, because typically, Eric, how many millions of hot dogs are consumed at ballparks during baseball season?
Americans eat about 20 million hot dogs at major league ballparks during the season. But we eat about 20 billion as the country throughout the whole year. So we certainly lost some sales during baseball season, and we're very sad not to be a part of the baseball season this year because everybody loves going to the ballpark. But in terms of impact on the bottom line, it hasn't had a huge impact because sales are up substantially at retail.
Okay, I was going to go there first, but I need to get clarification. Did you say Americans eat 20 billion hot dogs a year?
That is correct. 20 billion with a B. It's about 70 or so hot dogs per person each year.
Oh, wow. Now, does that include sausages, brats, stuff like that?
Yes, that would include both, yeah.
Okay. All right. Boy, that makes a little more sense to me. I don't know if I get all – you know, I don't know. I might. I'll have to give that some more thought, see if I'm helping the average or not, Eric. Where do you stand? Are you helping pull the average up?
Oh, I definitely help pull the average up, for sure.
Oh, I love it. I love it. So talk about those retail sales, because I was thinking about this. So many people had to learn to cook for the first time. For those people, hot dogs had to be a go-to, Eric.
Yeah, we saw in the early stages of the pandemic, hot dog sales were more than double what they were a year ago.
Wow.
And so people were turning to hot dogs. It's an easy food. It's a delicious food. You know, you're under pressure to feed your family. It's a food that makes your family happy that you know is going to be a winner. So hot dogs were very, very popular and relied upon. And we've been highlighting the different ways you can enjoy hot dogs. You know, it can be on the grill, but there's a lot of different ways to enjoy hot dogs and sausages. They're very versatile foods, and we've been celebrating that throughout the last several months.
Yeah, and those families with the young kids, Eric, when parents are looking for something that their kids are gonna eat, again, hot dogs are a go-to.
Yeah, and I've got a young one at home, and she loves her hot dogs, and so yeah, it's just something easy that you know, you can't figure out what you want. We serve up a hot dog, and they'll be happy.
Yeah, absolutely. So, the level of sales that we're seeing now, are we back to pre-COVID levels on those total sales?
Yeah, we're about what they typically are now.
Wow.
Typically in the summertime, sales are way up anyway compared to the rest of the year.
Yeah.
The peak grilling season is Memorial Day to Labor Day. So we're used to having pretty high hot dog and sausage sales throughout the summer period. Prices have gone up a little bit with the supply chain disruption and just the amount of product that's out there. So with prices up a little bit and kind of the summer season already being popular, we're right about where we normally are right now for the last few
weeks.
Right.
Exactly. You know, one of the impressive things that I saw at www.hot-dog.org is that you've got a video on there about how hot dogs are made, right?
We do. Yeah, we want to show the process of exactly what happens when hot dogs are made. There's so much mythology about how they're made and what's in them and the different ingredients that are used. And our goal is to be as transparent as possible. Here's exactly how it's done. We have an ingredients guide. Here are all the ingredients that you might find in a hot dog, what they are, why they're used. We want people to have that information so that they feel confident about the hot dogs they're eating.
Excellent. You know, and the product, the from the carcass that is used in making hot dogs, whether we're talking about, you know, the mixed meats or the all beef or the all pork, whatever, they are adding significant value to that carcass, because otherwise we may not have a use for some of the trimmings.
Yeah, and the hot dogs are made from the trimmings, and you know, so many consumers don't realize you know, the steaks and roasts are there in the animal, if you know, coming from the animals, but you've got a lot of meat that also comes as well, and so that meat goes into ground beef, other ground products, and hot dogs and sausages are another one of those ground products that is made with that meat and adds a lot of value to the animal. So we're really proud. It's a very sustainable food, and so it plays a really key role in the sustainability of the industry.
Absolutely. I love the fact that you keep coming back to that, Eric, the sustainability of it. So what are you doing to celebrate the month?
Well, we've been celebrating Wiener Wednesday for the last several weeks, and we're going to continue it throughout the month. You've heard of Taco Tuesday. Well,
yeah.
You know, when you're looking for easy meal solutions at home, you get your tacos on Tuesday, enjoy your wieners on Wednesday, and have a hot dog and sausage on Wednesday, and you've got 2 days of the week taken care of. And so we've been highlighting recipes on Wiener Wednesdays and partnering with TikTok influencers as well to highlight hot dogs and sausages. So just having a lot of fun throughout the month.
Exactly. You know, I was going to ask you if ketchup is okay on a hot dog, but I got a feeling you'd say, listen, whatever they want to put on them, as long as they're eating them.
We do say that, but we do have rules about ketchup. We have an etiquette guide on our website as well, and we say that if you're over the age of 18, it's time to put the ketchup away. Yeah. It's a frank faux pas to put ketchup on your hot dogs as an adult. So if you want the
nobody puts ketchup on a hot dog.
That's right. Straight from Dirty Harry.
Straight from Dirty Harry. That's right. Eric, this was fun. Thank you so much. And keep up the good work there on the sustainability side.
Thank you so much.
All right. We've got Ed Elfman from ABA up next.
Time for Markets Now with the experts from Pro Farmer.
And joining us now is Pro Farmer editor Brian Grady. Brian, a little bit of uncertainty in the forecast, it sounds like. The heat's going to stick around, but there may be some increased chances for some rain, huh?
Yeah, the models late yesterday afternoon added in a little bit better rain chances late this weekend, early next week. And so we'll see how it all pans out. Right now the corn market's under pressure, but it's off its session lows by about 3 cents. So we did see a little bit of buyer interest underneath the market, just not enough to push it to the upside. And so we'll see how it finishes. Soybean market, it's mixed right now, and wheat is actually the trying to move to the upside here. Pretty solid gains in SRW contracts, a little bit lesser in HRW contracts, and even lesser so in the spring wheat. But the fact of the matter is wheat futures are working higher in the winter wheat markets in the face of harvest.
Right, right. Yeah, that is impressive, no doubt about that. The crop condition reports that you got yesterday, any surprises to you, Beej?
No, I don't think so, to be honest. We had a slight downtick in both the corn and soybeans. We plug them into our weighted crop condition index and just a 1.3-point drop in corn and 1.7-point drop in soybeans. So we'll see. It looks like conditions will probably decline this week, but a lot of that depends on how the rains develop that we talked about earlier on here.
Yeah, exactly. A little bit of pressure on the meats.
A little bit, but all in all, I think the cattle market, we've seen a nice run up here recently, just kind of a pause today, a little bit of price pressure, like you mentioned. And then on the hog side of things, just slight losses in most of those contracts as well. Pretty quiet in the livestock markets here this morning.
Good stuff. Thanks, Beej. That's Pro Farmer editor Brian Grady.
Opinions expressed on AgriTalk do not necessarily reflect the views of Farm Journal Broadcasting, affiliate stations, or sponsors.
I'm Andrew McRae, inviting you to join me for Farming the Countryside, a farmer-focused podcast important to agriculture, and is brought to you by Pivot BioProven. Visit pivotbio.com to find a representative near you.
$20 billion, Davis. 20 yeah. billion hot dogs, sausages, bratwurst consumed in America every year. That is about 70 per person.
You know, if we work hard, that's huge. I bet we could get it to 30 billion. If we really all just give that extra inch, you know what I mean?
You gotta commit. You gotta commit.
Yes. I'm willing to commit to 100 hot dogs, brats, and or sausages this year.
Attaboy.
Who's with me?
I'll go with you.
All right.
All right. Let's get to Ed Elfman. He is the Senior VP for Agriculture and Rural Bank Policy at the American Bankers Association. He joins us right now. Ed, thank you so much for making time for us.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I got to say, I'm pro ketchup, though, regardless of your last conversation.
Even with the warning from Dirty Harry in there, huh?
Yeah. Ketchup and mustard. Got to have both of them. Just a classic.
Hey, look, we accept all walks of life here. We're not here to judge, all right? What you do in your own kitchen is your business.
Wow. Ed, tell us about the ABA, who the members are, and the mission of ABA.
Yeah, so the American Bankers Association, we represent all banks, everything from banks that have one employee up to JP Morgan Chase. I mean, we're the premier organization representing banks across the entire industry. Our mission is to advocate for banks in Washington, D.C., make sure that Capitol Hill and the administration knows what we need and what we're looking for to make sure that we can help our customers across the country. On the agricultural side of the world, about 80% of the banks in the country have ag in their portfolio. It's often not realized by a lot of people. And it's 50% of the agricultural lending in the country is done by banks. So it's given me a nice little carve out at the ABA to make sure that agriculture is represented in the finance markets from our perspective, from the DC perspective. So that's our mission and role there, is to make sure that agricultural banks are represented in DC appropriately.
Gotcha. So how'd you come to be at ABA and representing the ag and rural banks?
Well, I had the fortune / misfortune of being a dairy farm kid in Minnesota. So grew up working in a stall barn and knew I didn't want to do that for a living. My dad and my brother still farm full time up there, not dairy anymore. We got out of that side of the world. But I came out to D.C. Wanting to do policy, working on that side of it. I worked on Capitol Hill for a couple years, and I was at the National Corn Growers at one point and hopped on with ABA about 8 years ago when they had an opening for an agricultural guy.
Gotcha. Good. So, Enhancing Credit Opportunities in Rural America Act, ECORA. What is it, and what would it do for rural bankers?
So ECORA, the short answer here, is it removes the taxation on income from interest. And essentially what that means for a bank is it lowers their cost of putting together a loan on ag real estate, right? So any sort of land loan that you have, farmland loan, you're taxed at 21% federally and then whatever your state level tax is. This bill would remove the federal taxation from farmland loans, thus reducing the cost of putting a loan together. And for farmers and producers, it would be reflected in their interest rates, because an interest rate is essentially a combination of risk and cost. So if you cut out part of the cost, you're going to lower interest rates. It just by competition with banks, with each other, with other non-bank lenders. So ECORA, the long and short of it, ECORA reduces interest rates for producers by reducing the cost for banks to put together those loans.
Wow. Okay. So you trickled it down to interest rates, trickle it even further to the land market and any influence that it might have there, because it seems to me, obviously, that's going to be a supportive factor for the land prices.
Correct. I mean, when you're putting together a land loan, you're talking long-term interest, all those types of things. It sets up your collateral. I mean, land is essential for agriculture, right? It sets up every other piece of financing that you have in that area. By reducing the cost, the tax for the banks, you have now automatically knocked that interest rate down, and you've helped farmers, right? I look back, I have friends that $1,200 a year in interest broke them, right? But if we can reduce those interest costs, and especially on the beginning farmer side of the world, right, reduce those interest costs, it'll make it easier for farmers to meet those obligations, make sure that they're not getting too overextended, whatever it might be, and reduce their costs, especially going into this environment, first of all, from the COVID side of the world, which has changed everything for us on markets. But going into this long-term agricultural cycle we've been in, we're waiting for that, when that peak might hit, we're on the downslope, right? If we're not already on it without realizing it, this will reduce the costs for farmers and producers. And that's the big thing. We need to reduce those costs for farmers and producers.
Right. Absolutely. Okay, good. The financial condition of ag is going to determine the condition of the ag lenders out there. What's the scorecard look like for the ag banks right now, Ed?
Ag banks are actually very strong. They're well capitalized. They're in a very good spot. From our metrics, over 1,700 banks are considered farm banks, which is about a third of the banks in the United States. And our metrics are 15% of their portfolio is in agriculture. So not a huge number, but it's a large portion of their portfolio. But they're very strong, well capitalized. And actually, the farm bank group increased their farm lending last year by up to $105 billion. Okay. So they're increasing their ag lending because agriculture is viewed as a strong sector to lend in. Even though the economy is where it is, farming's become more sophisticated. It's become more like other businesses, right? Where you're really capitalizing on your inputs and outputs and figuring out how to make everything work, make the math work. So banks have gotten even more into the business, and it's turned out well for them. Another factor, just to let you know, on the farm bank side of the world, they've increased employment by 3%, adding almost 2,500 jobs in the last year. So we're seeing people go into agricultural banking, which is a good thing, right? Because the more people that understand agriculture and the finance behind it, the more we can help farmers into the future.
Yeah, absolutely. When a farmer goes into an ag bank right now, what should they expect from that bank? It's because the financial conditions out there are such that if you don't maintain your communications, we always say don't go dark on your banker is one of our favorite lines here. But what should a farmer expect from their ag banks?
There's going to be a lot of questions, a lot of making sure that everything lines up the way that we think it's going to, right? So have your documentation lined up with you. Have a very clear path of what you're looking to do over the next year, heck, over the next year, 5 years, 10 years. What's your long-term plan, right? What are you trying to achieve? But when you go in, those conversations, not that they weren't frank before, I think they're going to be very frank now. Because we got to be honest with each other, right?
Yeah.
If something doesn't cash flow, is it the right thing to do? Just because you've done it for 20 years doesn't mean it's maybe the best way to view that side of the world. I know from reading different things you've done over the years, looking at things like forward contracting and marketing and doing all those things appropriately. If you're someone who hasn't been on that side of the world, bankers are going to talk to you about it and say, hey, how are you marketing your crops out? What are you looking at? Partly because what we're trying to do from the banking industry, like every other business that we work with and we lend to, what are your costs and what are your profits, right? Figure out what those numbers are, and the loans work a lot easier. They just do. So I think that's going to be a big part of what you're hearing when you walk into banks is what's your plan? What's your business plan? What does it look like? We have a conference every year, 700 bankers come to it. And one of the things we've been teaching over the last couple of years is really this idea of having a business plan, being a better business manager. That's the future of where we're going with that. And for some folks, it might be a little bit of a shock, being, you know, treated more like a coffee shop when you walk in. What is your inputs and outputs? But the truth of the matter is it's becoming sophisticated business, and we have to have those kind of conversations to make sure farms are strong going into the future.
Exactly. Okay. Back to ECORA here. What's been the reception among the lawmakers?
So we have 5 senators on and 17 House members. I think part of it is it's a new idea, right? Well, newish idea. It's been around for about 25 years, but it hasn't been pushed the way it's been pushed in the last year, 2 years. Part of that is we live in a new world with social media and all those things. We can make a lot more noise around different issues than we used to be able to in the past. The reception right now is really, they're not hearing from farmers probably enough on the legislation itself. That's partly on us, making sure we're educating farmers about what this is, what it does for them. And I think another part of it is we're in a little bit of a standstill in D.C., waiting to have some votes on future packages, trying to figure out what the rest of the summer might look like, how many more bills are they going to do this year, all those types of things. So getting ECORA included in one of those packages is a priority of ours. Because I will tell you this, if you don't see it in an upcoming package, it's something that won't go away. Because for ag relief, ECORA makes all the sense in the world.
Excellent. Ed, that was a good conversation. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you, and let me know if you ever want me back on.
You know it. You know we will. All right, that is Ed Elfman. He is the Senior VP for Ag and Rural Bank Policy at the American Bankers Association. Davis and I will be right back to wrap things up.
Do you suffer from talking on the radio phobia? No problem. Send us a tweet at hashtag AgriTalk.
All right, welcome back. Glad that you could join us this morning. Informative morning, wouldn't you say, Davis?
I would say. And can I just have a moment's time here? You know, speaking of tweeting to hashtag AgriTalk, at Oto Creek Cattle. Bring something up, okay? And it's sort of a twofold tweet here. December 3rd, 2019. It's that time of year when I thoroughly enjoy listening to AgriTalk Market Reports over any Christmas music. Okay? Then, just a few moments ago, she tweets out, Christmas music sounds not too bad compared to the markets right now. Well, I would offer something else as far as music goes, especially given the content, the topics around today. It goes a little something like this.
Sausages are good. I want sausages. Sausages are good. I want sausages.
Hot dog.
Sausages.
Hot dog.
Sausages are good. I love sausages.
I've wanted to have Eric on in the past, but I didn't want to just make a joke out of National Hot Dog Month or anything like that. And the COVID angle and the impact of the shutdown on hot dog demand, sausage, brats, Italian sausage, you know, the whole long list of things, I thought was really interesting. And when he made the comment that we are back to pre-COVID levels, because this is grilling season, we're into the middle of it now. But you think about all of those, and I'm not making fun of anybody when I say this, but in so many cases, there were first-time home cooks. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are younger adults with very skilled jobs living in urban areas that when they rented an apartment, the last thing that they were giving consideration to was what kind of a stove and refrigerator were in the kitchen because they knew they were going to be eating out every night.
Mm-hmm.
Well, all of a sudden, that changes. Now I need to learn to cook at home. Oh my gosh, look at this. Hey, I can at least start here. Mom told me how I can do this. What? Mm-hmm. And so it's been a boom. It's been a boom for the hot dog and sausages.
Well, and between Zoom meetings, between tasks, you need a quick lunch. I mean, it doesn't take long to cook up a hot dog. A bratwurst maybe a little bit longer. You know, you got to get it up to temperature, of course. But, it's steak in a tube, baby. It's steak in a tube. Pork chop in a tube. What could be better?
That's right. And as far as the value of trim, the beef trim, pork trim, what it adds to a carcass, can you imagine if we did not have a market for that product?
Yeah. That'd be a terrible waste.
Yes, absolutely.
Just for one.
Yeah. Absolutely, it would be a terrible waste, and we'd be missing that much more value. So it was a good story. It was a good time to do it, and I'm glad that that Eric was available to come on and talk about what's happening in that market. I'm a little surprised that he stuck to the no ketchup thing, though, dude.
I'm with him on that.
Hey, well, I'm fine with it. I don't eat ketchup on my hot dog, but, I mean, in the position that he's in, I would definitely be the, I don't care if you want to put maple syrup on your hot dog.
Just eat it. Just eat it.
And have another one. Let's get to that 100.
Yeah. No, I would tackle a guy who tried to put maple syrup on his hot dog.
You don't know what you're doing. Stop.
Well, and here's a tip for the, you mentioned the people who maybe don't normally cook or whatever, and maybe are new to cooking food at home. If you really want to go to level 2.0 with your hot dog, right?
Okay.
You get yourself a dill pickle spear.
Oh yeah.
And you warm up your dog, you put it in the bun, and you lay that spear right in the bun right next to it.
Yep. Oh,
now you got something. And technically, I think it then counts as a hot dog salad. I'm not sure on that. I'd have to check. But you add that pickled cucumber in there, and now you've got vegetables involved. That's a square meal, baby. Enjoy a delicious, maybe a fruit smoothie, or even better yet, a delicious glass of milk with it. I mean, everybody's happy.
There you go. Yeah. You know,
boy, we're doing some good today, aren't we?
We are. We are. 2016, I kicked off the World Series, play with for the Cubs with the Chicago style hot dogs cooked right here at the Flory Ranch.
Oh, yeah, man.
Oh, here's an interesting one. Do you know what is a often forgotten ingredient in that Chicago style hot dog that like makes it for me? Celery salt. Yep. Gotta have it.
I did not know that. Yeah.
It's not the same if you don't include it. That's right. Hey, if you want to learn more about the Enhancing Credit Opportunities in Rural America Act,
yes,
you can go to the ABA website, okay? It's easy to get to. It's www.aba.com. Just start there, and banking topics will be up at the top of the list. Go to that and to learn more about it. The trickle-down influence of this act, if it passes, where you're taking the taxes off of the interest that the banks include, the banks need to be passing that on to somebody. One bank's going to pass that on to the consumer, to the farmer that's buying ground. And if they do that, they're going to be the most competitive, and everybody's going to have to follow suit. And it, boy, that trickle-down effect, I really like the way that that is intended to work. And I like the idea of what Ed was saying, that, hey, if it doesn't get included in a package of must-pass legislation this year, they're not going to back off it. They're going to continue to bring it up.
All right. Sounds great. All right.
Sounds like a story for a landowner, if you ask me.
You think?
Yes, I do. All right. Thanks for listening this morning. You got to come back this afternoon. John Payne, Daniel's Trading, This Week in Grain, Swine Times. He's going to be our guest. Tomorrow morning, we got a farmer forum and Brad Rippey, USDA meteorologist.
Ooh.